Welcome to episode 15 of the Librarian's Guide to Teaching podcast. I'm Amanda.
And I'm Jessica.
And on today's episode, we are going to kick off part two of our three-part framework series. But before we get started with our conversation, how are you doing and anything exciting happening this week?
No, not really. Just continuing to adjust to staying at home, working at home life. Taking one day at a time, as we've talked about before, but everything's good. So I can't necessarily complain.
Yeah, same here. Can't complain. It's a lot of the same, working, managing a toddler, cooking three meals a day, cleaning three meals a day. But everyone's happy and healthy. So, you know, at least we're thankful for that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. All right, so why don't we jump right into our episode today. So in our last episode, we talked about challenges, and today we're going to talk about maybe some topics that don't necessarily get written about a lot, but I think it was fun to think about these things because I didn't necessarily think about them. So we're going to talk about our likes and our dislikes of the framework. So why don't we get started? What do you like and dislike about the framework?
Right. Yeah. So last week we kind of talked a little more officially about like challenges and pros and cons, but this is a little more about what we like. So I really like the way that the topics that make up the six frames are worded and described. I know last time we talked about the language being complex and how that can be a challenge, and you weren't necessarily a fan of it, but I think I've come to like it after actually working with it for the past few years. At this point, I don't think I would know any other way to describe authority other than constructed and contextual. At first, I was like, what does this mean? But now I've seen it applied to so many situations, and I think I've absorbed it. So I've gotten past that threshold concept, and I understand it, and it just makes sense to me now. So overall, I think I like the language now. And so the second thing I like is the flexibility that the complexity of it allows. We discussed that some of the challenges of that complexity can provide, but overall I think that there are a lot of opportunities for interpretation and implementation, and that does become a strength at some point. There are some examples later that we're going to talk about of some studies that really show different applications that can be explored because of the complexity of the framework, the different frames, the knowledge practices, the dispositions, the language. If it wasn't that complex, we wouldn't necessarily be able to talk about it in this much depth and do these studies. Actually, I didn't really talk about what I dislike, I guess, because I feel like I talked about it a little bit last week with the challenges, but what about you?
So I have come to appreciate the framework for its complexity. I agree with you on that point. I think it does lend itself to different opportunities that the standards didn't lend themselves to. So I can appreciate the intentions of the framework. I do really like the addition of scholarship as a conversation. That was definitely something that was missing from the standards. Interestingly enough, it is the hardest to teach in class. I know for a fact, because we assess what we teach in our classes, it is the least taught frame in a classroom setting, but in our one-to-one instruction where we do research consultations, we find that there's more opportunity to talk about scholarship as a conversation. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of been exciting to do that outside of the classroom, to just talk it out with students. And the few times that we've been able to incorporate it into our instruction, specifically in our honors program, it's given us a nice opportunity to expose our students who are potentially interested in moving on towards graduate school. Mm-hmm. So that's been a nice opportunity. There are a few things that I dislike besides the challenges that I discussed. So I'm going to get a little granular here. I kind of dislike authority as constructed and contextual. And it's not that I dislike the concepts. I just don't think it's realistic for the instruction that I have to provide in the classroom. Mm-hmm. It's exciting for sure. If I was teaching a credit-bearing course and could teach anything I wanted, I think it would be really easy. But, you know, like we talked about with Barbara Pfister, the assignments that are created for college, you know, courses are so traditional that professors don't want students questioning traditional scholars of specific disciplines or questioning authority in that way. So it makes it a little difficult. And I've gotten pushback before where I'll try and teach to this frame and the professors are like, yeah, that's great, but you can't use that source in your paper. So it's a conflicting message. So I've
got
to be away from that because I want to be united and I want to be providing the students the instruction that they need to be successful. So it's like, I want to make sure I'm not trying to push my agenda on the instruction. So authority is contextual is kind of too lofty for what I have to provide to the students.
And I guess that's where the institutional context comes in, because it's like some colleges where they may have different assignments that lend itself to that, and we're asked to teach the assignment, or if we're given carte blanche, like that would be awesome. But in your case, you know, it doesn't necessarily work when you have that institutional context. So.
Right. And another thing that I do find a little challenging is that, you know, it's hard, like we talked about, to teach students some of these dispositions. How am I going to teach a student and assess them if they can appreciate the complexity of a simple search? Get them to value something in a 50-minute session. Like, it's just not possible, you know? I don't think that the creators, had the one-shot instruction in mind when they made these recommendations. And then lastly is that, you know, I was going back and forth between the standards and the framework, and I noticed that the framework, that many of the knowledge practices and the dispositions are very lower order thinking and not progressive. It's very much like students have to understand or acknowledge. It's not create, apply, demonstrate. It's very lower order thinking. So like that, I end up making my own progression because I want students to move forward with just beyond getting something, like saying, okay, I understand it. Multiple choice, I understand this concept, you know? So I found that a little challenging when I've been, you know, teaching the framework.
That's interesting. I actually hadn't noticed that. So that's for the knowledge practices?
Yeah, and some of the dispositions, but mostly for the knowledge practices, yeah.
Wow, interesting. Yeah, that's something I'm going to have to go back and take a look at.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess maybe because if what comes after it is like very complex, they're still getting they're still getting a complex idea, but like you said, it's still not like applying something or higher level critical thinking in that way with the verb that's being used. Yeah.
Exactly. So here's kind of a fun question. Do you have a favorite frame?
So I really like talking about searching as strategic exploration, and maybe it's kind of a cop-out because I'm, as the introduction to the frame says, it's encompassing inquiry, discovery, and serendipity. So I'm trying to get more than one frame in the one that I'm picking. So we can have discussions about research as inquiry because searchers have to understand their information need first and the scope to know where to look. And then we can discuss the entire information ecosystem because the knowledge practice says that they need to, quote, identify interested parties. So we're looking at the information ecosystem. So I like that it brings in multiple frames together. And there are a lot of those practical, like, aha moments that you can get out of it. That you might have with the standards when you're using search tips, finding sources, and you kind of see the fruits of their labor a little bit easier. But at the same time, I do like authority as constructed because I love those conversations about authority, and it leads to the misinformation, fake news stuff, which I love. So,
Yeah.
What about you?
Well, just to kind of touch upon that, the searching as strategic, I don't think it's a cop-out. I think it's easy to teach to. Like you said, it does touch upon a lot. It's one of our most taught frames. I think a lot of librarians can agree that they probably teach the strategic one and researchers inquiry the most. I know we do. But I really like information creation as a process. I think it really lends itself to a lot of active learning. And in my opinion, it has been easy to assess. I just think that just the way that the knowledge practices like are worded, it's just, I love the idea of talking to students and getting them to think about where information comes from. Mm-hmm. And, that it doesn't just come from one place, and that the creation of that information is different in different contexts, and the product of that information. And so I don't know, I've always found that kind of exciting. I do this one activity in an English class where I kind of talk to them about like the evolution of, like, if you're writing if you're looking for information about a current event, you're not going to find a book about it, because mm-hmm. that information hasn't been created. It hasn't been around long enough. And a lot of them seem to get it, but they don't necessarily think about information in that way. So I think it's like, it lends itself to a lot of simple conversations that they can kind of get, but also allows them to reflect, and again, allows me to assess it easily.
Yeah, I like that one a lot too.
Yeah, yeah. So do you have some cool examples of framework use?
Yeah, I have one or two that I've used and one that I'd really like to use. So I haven't done this a lot in the past year or so, but I love using current social media and news media scenarios to teach about information authority and information has value. I just think that those examples are so ripe with ideas and things that students can relate to. I mean, right now the whole Zoom situation is a great example. I mean, they were selling people's data to Facebook. and it's something that so many people are being forced to use for work, and that students might be using with their families. So it's just stuff that they're dealing with on a daily basis that they can connect to because they're seeing it in their real lives. One resource that I've been loving recently related to this is the email newsletter from the News Literacy Project called The Sift, because they provide summaries of these type of current issues, and then they give you discussion questions you can use in the classroom. So this week's email's main story was COVID-19 misinformation online. So the discussion questions were, do you consider the spread of medical misinformation online a serious problem? If so, how serious? Have you or anyone you know ever been affected by medical misinformation? So they're getting students to think about their story related to this situation, provide their information story, but then put it into more of like framework contexts. So I'd really like to start using some of their discussion questions in the classroom. So I'd love to do a workshop too on visual literacy, kind of similar, but not really, kind of the way that images get manipulated online and the different tools that can be used to verify information. But I haven't planned anything yet on that.
I like that idea, the visual literacy. I think that would be very interesting. I think you'd get a lot of interest with students on that from a personal level, honestly.
Yeah, there can be practical stuff they can use in there.
Yeah, yeah.
So my other one is one I know I've talked about before in terms of the edit-a-thons that I've done. But again, those are just really ripe for conversations on authority, searching, information creation. So I didn't want to leave it out. And at ALA last year, I presented a poster with our colleagues from Berklee College, Lori McFadden and Bonnie Lafazan, on our edit-a-thons that we did. And in our poster, we had a chart of the framework where we laid out how each aspect of the activities we did were linked to a frame. So I'll link to our poster in the show notes, because it can really help to see how the frames are connected to specific skills related to Wikipedia. And you don't have to do a full edit-a-thon either. I mean, you could select one frame and then one set of potential skills and just teach to those in a single session as an option. Like, authority can be addressed by discussing the concept of Wikipedia and who edits it, plus the structure of the references. The knowledge practice about identifying interested parties from searching and strategic exploration can be discussed when they're selecting the best sources as references when editing and things like that. So I think edit-a-thons are so ripe for framework use and connection.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know we've talked about the Edit-a-thon before, and it does sound like a really great collaborative project that does touch upon a lot of the frames. And it's not something that I think a professor would think to incorporate into as a standardized assignment. So I think it's something fun, but also has a lot of practical purpose for sure.
Yeah, and it's pretty scalable. I mean, you can start small, but then go up to a full participatory campus-wide event.
Right, right.
So the last one I wanted to touch on was one of my favorite sessions at ALA last year was called Beyond CRAP, An Updated Approach to Source Evaluation. It was presented by Mary Thill, Frank Lambert, and James Rosenweig. I'll post their original article and their accompanying LibGuide in the show notes. What I liked from a practical standpoint when I saw their presentation was the set of source evaluation criteria that they created to teach students. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just, you know, evaluating the about page of something. It was a lot more detailed. It was, for example, for evaluating an author, they would consider the expertise of that author. Were they a layman, someone who was a professional amateur, someone who was an academic professional, and they gave examples in the rubric so that students could see what that person might be. Like a layman would be like Jenny McCartney, who thinks that she can talk about vaccines, right? She has no expertise, but she has a platform. So then they consider the editorial process. Was it self-published, peer-reviewed, vanity press? And most students don't know those concepts. I mean, I even learned a few of them in the presentation, but understanding these concepts can be valuable skills for students in the real world once they get out of college. When they look at a book in a bookstore, they can understand, you know, how these books were produced. And it's kind of the information creation as a process thing, evaluating authority based on that process, not just about the person. So I thought that was really cool. And I was hoping to use it for the honors program, but then I left Berkeley a few months later.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the honors program, I think that is probably one of the coolest ways we've been able to use the framework.
Yeah.
At Berkeley, I feel like I've talked about the honors a little bit before, but at Berkeley, we are very fortunate that we are so integrated in the honors program where we are collaborating with faculty and our academic support center for a whole entire year for three courses. And every single frame is represented. The students really, you know, we work with students from the beginning to the end of helping them, you know, develop a topic to learning research skills, reinforcing those research skills through like simple quizzes and, you know, tutorials and quizzes, and then also assignment grading and, you know, in-class support and one-on-one research. And, you know, we really get to touch upon every single frame, and it really is the coolest way that we've been able to teach to and assess the framework. It's, you know, I could talk about our honors for hours just because it's a unique opportunity. But it's actually changing next year. We're actually condensing it to only two semesters.
Whoa.
Yeah, so that's going to be a little challenging, I think, trying to teach students the whole entire research process in two semesters and having them finish and write a completed 25-page research paper. So that'll change. I mean, they'll still get to learn everything. We'll still get to teach them everything we already set to teach them, but it's just going to be really condensed.
Yeah.
So we'll see. But that's like one of my most dynamic examples.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, yeah. So our last question is, wanted to discuss a few studies that have been done on the framework. So Jessica, you want to get us started?
Yeah, I had trouble picking mine because there's just so many good studies out there. So I narrowed it down to two. One is mine, selfishly. One is a bunch of other people's. But so this is really like the one big thing I've done with the framework was a study on LibChat transcripts that I'm really proud of. I worked on that with About Berkeley College LibChat Services, where we analyzed evidence of instruction using the framework as the basis for our analysis. So the article is called Chat Reference, Evaluating Customer Service and IL Instruction. And I wrote it with our colleagues, Julie Hunter, Dina Mecki, and Samantha Kanagizer. So we reviewed the framework and selected the knowledge, practices, and dispositions that we felt could be taught in virtual chat. And then we reviewed transcripts of chats and coded anytime those frames were taught. And we had like a norming session where we decided how to code things. So from the coding, we were able to determine a set of best practices that might encourage instruction to take place within chat. We didn't continue the study after that first one, but I could see us adding the frames to LibChat Ref Analytics and starting to kind of collect that self-reported information from librarians, which might have continued the study to see if the best practices made a difference. But that was something that I really thought was a fun way to apply the framework to LibChat.
Absolutely. I loved that project. I thought it was a very unique thing to do. I think, you know, as I've mentioned before, we consider instruction anything beyond 15 minutes of a one-on-one session is considered instruction. So, you know, some of our reference questions on chat are sometimes an hour, you know, are teaching that student a particular frame or a knowledge practice or whatever. So I think that's really exciting. I really wanted to push for this to continue. I did want it to be a part of the Ref Analytics because I think it's such important data to be collecting. So, and I get it, it's a lot of onus on the librarian to have to record that after the fact, but I think it's such valuable information because we do support our students. But what we have done is that Lib Answers and Lib Chat has this new feature where you can tag the chats. And so it might be a little easier. We're starting to do it now where we're tagging the chats, but like we're picking what we, like we picked our tags, like our predetermined tags, and you could easily put the frames that way. For me, I think it's useful because it allows me to go back, because I review chat transcripts every semester from the previous semester, and I look for trends in course assignments that students are struggling with. But if you put the six frames there, like keep it broad, I could easily see a librarian just tagging it to that particular frame. Because I think at this point, my people know the frames well enough to say, oh, well, that's this frame, you know, without having to even look at the document. So I would love to push to add those. And, you know, I don't even know why I didn't think about it until I brought it up, but I think I'm going to add that. I think I'm going to recommend that we add those frames to the tags because it is valuable data for sure.
Yay, let me know how it goes. And I think that's another thing that's so institutional specific. Like I remember at Berkeley, the chats were so dynamic and we had such different conversations and more instructional based conversations than I'm having now with students at Pace. And I think some of it may come down to marketing, you know, like our students are just so reliant on chat at Berkeley, whereas where I am at Pace now, students are less so. And so that's kind of a marketing slash cultural thing that is just different resources that the students use versus don't use. So it could be an institutional thing that it may work for other places more, and instruction may happen more, but it was definitely something that I think was cool that we use the framework as the basis and could be applied in different ways.
Absolutely.
So the other study that I found interesting is called Reorienting an Information Literacy Program Towards Social Justice, Mapping the Core Values of Librarianship to the ACRL Framework. That was by Lua Gregory and Shayna Higgins. Sorry if I got her name wrong. One thing I really liked about the article was how it questioned and gave us some different perspectives around assessment. So I thought it would be interesting to talk about with you. So last episode, we talked a little bit about the flexibility of the framework posing an issue for benchmarking because it is a national set of standards. And in their introduction, the authors talk about, or they state, quote, while the framework still operates as a form of standardization, professional permission to create a situated standardization may result in more meaningful teaching, learning, and assessment. So, you know, they're saying, depending on the institution, depending on the professor, doing assessment their way may be more meaningful.
Hmm.
So they go on to talk about the wariness of assessment within the critical pedagogy community, because it can become negative when it is, quote, an attempt to reduce complexity to a quantifiable metric, to link learning to returns on investment and the marketplace, and to fill reports for assessment auditors, end quote. Mm-hmm. And so they talked a little bit about, too, the historical background behind assessment going back to the 60s when it had to do with the achievement gap and things like that, which was an interesting context that they added. So you'd have to read the article. I won't go into that here.
Yeah.
But what I like is their push for reflection around assessment and to create qualitative assessments that may not be acceptable for reports, but they show us that students are learning new ways of thinking about information. So the main part of their study was really mapping the ALA core values with the framework and then creating learning outcomes that were mapped to both. So authority as constructed and contextual was mapped to the ALA core value for democracy, diversity, and social responsibility.
Right.
And then they created learning outcomes for that frame, such as students will learn to question and remain skeptical of authority in order to remain open to new perspectives and a range of voices. So that's kind of cool. But like we said, not necessarily a super easy, accessible learning outcome in the way we traditionally think about it. So they quoted an interviewee from another article by Eamon Toole, who said, quote, I can't put changed lives and enacted social change on a rubric, but I'm pressured to report student learning findings in ways that are rubricable. So I do the rubric, but I still find my own qualitative assessment alongside the stuff that I'm required to report. And I think that's something valuable to consider. So how can we make a rubric / quantifiable assessment as transformative for students as possible? And then if we can't, balance it with more qualitative assessment that tells us that we're making a more meaningful impact on students. As someone who's like admittedly new to critical pedagogy, I just appreciated the ideas that they presented and giving librarians things to think about in terms of learning outcomes and assessment. And what are we really asking students to think about? I mean, obviously it's valuable to teach them how to use a database and how to find search information and how to find things on Google. Those are obviously valuable skills, but as they said, so is teaching them to think critically about authority and potentially enact social change. Those are important things that we could do also. So yeah, I really liked that one.
So complicated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Complicated.
When you don't think that way, it's a new way to think.
Right. But like, you get pushback from people on assessing things that are easy to assess. Imagine getting a group of people to commit to assessing everything in that capacity. I think that would be a huge challenge.
Yeah. And I mean, you're looking at it too from your at like a programmatic level too. So that can be really challenging.
Yeah, I think it's not sustainable. I think my biggest like mantra word so far for 2020 is sustainability. Like, what is sustainable? And something like that to me would definitely not be sustainable. Like, I think it's a lofty goal. I think it's very noble in a perfect world, but you know, I'd have to go back and read the whole article.
Yeah.
But
it's worth a read.
I do think that people would push back on the sustainability of it. Listen, I'm all for demonstrating students' critical thinking skills. I think it's important to, like you said, go beyond the students demonstrated that they can search in a database. You know, we incorporate a lot of those ideas in our rubrics already. You know, were they able to synthesize the sources? Were they able to add their thoughts? You know, were there any original thoughts in their work? So we're doing it, and it's a challenge. You know, it takes time, but I think it would be hard to implement something like this across the board and sustain it forever. So I'm definitely going to go back. I must have missed that one.
Yeah, that was an interesting one, and I think at least, like you said, sustainability for a whole program may be hard, but it's something that I'm thinking about in my critical pedagogy journey. And yeah. I'm going to, you know, at least think about it from my little slice of the library world and go from there. Who knows?
Right. And you know what? I think it might work for some programs and maybe maybe not others. Yeah. If information literacy is integrated into a particular program, and one of the program's core standards or skills that need to be taught kind of speaks to that, then maybe it's appropriate. Maybe it's like more like it wouldn't be so challenging because it's something that they have to learn already. So that, you know, some programs might lend itself to that and others might not.
Right.
Yeah. So those are,
what
those
were yours?
So I found the one that I wanted to focus on because I didn't want to overload people, but the one that I found that I thought was kind of interesting and different from the ones that you picked was about awareness and implementation. So it was in I think it's in the January College and Research Libraries issue. It's called Community College Librarians and the ACRL Framework, Findings from a National Study. So I thought this was interesting because I know a lot of the pushback that I've given and that a number of my colleagues in New Jersey have given is that it's not for everybody. It does not reach every single type of college or university. And this one specifically focuses on the community college, and it talks about, are they implementing it? Are they familiar with it? What are their challenges with applying the framework in their institutions? And so some of the interesting statistics that they found in their study was that only 11% of people who completed their study claimed that they were very familiar with the framework. 11%. I mean, that's not a lot. The framework has been around. This is a study that was conducted recently. I mean, the framework's been around since, 2016?
This was community college librarians?
Community college librarians.
How many, do you know how many off the top of your head they surveyed?
They surveyed 1,200 community colleges.
Wow.
Yes. They surveyed 1,200 community colleges. So to me, that was like a big deal, you know?
Yeah.
So, and yeah, I gotta say, I'm not surprised, you know, when in every interview that I've sat in on, when we hired new people, we always bring up the framework. We always ask people, how have they used it? What are they familiar with? And sometimes it's blank stares. Sometimes,
really?
I don't know the framework, but I will learn it. Mm-hmm. And others are like, I have limited knowledge of the framework. So, like, to me, it just goes to show you that, yes, it was adopted, but people are still not integrating it into their institutions. They're not finding it. What I thought was interesting was that 35% said they made moderate alterations to their instruction to incorporate the framework. Mm. And 23% said that they have no alterations to their instruction, so they're not implementing it. So that's kind of, interesting to me too, that you have all these people that are just not, they're not finding opportunities. One comment that I thought was interesting that I think makes sense was that a lot of people from community colleges wish that there were examples to scale down the framework. Mm-hmm. Make it appropriate for their student population, which I thought was interesting. I think, we need to make this document work for everybody, and I don't think it does. And this study really does shed a light that, people are still struggling. And then one other stat that I thought was interesting and worth noting is that 45% reported that they had not read the entire document.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say I'm surprised because we talked about it is like a heavy document and like you have to read it multiple times. I mean, I can't even tell you how many times I've read this document and I still, I still have to go back to it and read it. I don't as much anymore because we have our own, we coded it. So I just use our coding. I don't even use the document anymore, but like when I really want to get like a little nitty gritty, I'll go back. Or when I'm trying to refer to something and like, in something professional, like a writing or scholarship, I'll go back to it, but I don't. But I've definitely read the entire document multiple times.
Right.
So it's definitely worth a read. It came out in 2020. I think it's like the first volume for 2020 for college research and libraries.
Yeah, I think it touches on our big theme that we've unknowingly unveiled for this episode, is just how institution-specific framework adoption might be, because it depends on who your students are, who your faculty are, how much they might push back on some of the frames, what opportunities are there for you to incorporate these specific frames and concepts, at what level can you teach the concepts? Are you just going to teach the idea that authority is constructed, or are you going to really get down to assessing the knowledge, practices, and dispositions? So it really depends on institution specific, and also one shot versus a full course versus program implementation. So it really depends.
I think when it comes to, and I think this article touched upon it too, is the adoption rate really depends on people at a higher level engaging with the framework and wanting it to be integrated into their department, you know? So if you have directors and, you know, VPs or deans of libraries that want this, they will push for it, mm-hmm. but others might not. So that, you know, in my experience, you know, in meetings that I've had with librarians or conversations or interest groups or whatever, it's been like, well, we're kind of using it, but not really. No one's really pushing us to use it. So we kind of use it sometimes. That's like a big thing that I've heard a lot. And I think, you know, I don't know, to me, that's challenging. To me, that's like, how, you know, I'm really about national standards, and I know it's not like cookie cutter like that, and it doesn't have to be, but like, I really wish that like it would be easier for people to implement, and that people wouldn't be so afraid of it, and that, you know, in the article that I just talked about, they also talked about how people would implement it if they had more professional development opportunities and time. That. So I think it's also about time too. I think it's a document that really needs to be deconstructed. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the reasons maybe it's a huge barrier for people, that they haven't had an opportunity to kind of deconstruct it and make it work for them.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see in the future if someone does complementary studies of college level and then university research library level to kind of see what the adoption rate is different across the institutions and all the different metrics that they measured.
Yeah, yeah.
Might be interesting.
Yeah, for sure. So that wraps up this portion of our episode. We're going to move on to our weekly segment of what we have learned this week. So Jessica, you want to start us off? What have you learned this week?
So I guess mine's not necessarily instruction related, but it is library related. So I do I'm on the social media team for the library, and I've really been enjoying it through this whole remote learning, work from home thing, because we've had to post so much more, because it's one way that we can really engage with the students and find different ways to post our content. So I've been enjoying doing that. And through that process, I learned how to use the Instagram link in bio, which I've used as a Instagram user, clicking on the link in someone's bio on Instagram and then getting the whole thread of all of their different links and stuff. So I learned how to create one, and it felt really rewarding to just be like, oh, there, it's so much more organized now. Because we were just posting bit.lys either in the caption or in the picture. And I just know as a user, I hate having to type that out onto my computer or my phone. And so this just makes it so much easier. So what I learned was how to do the Instagram link in bio. And what I've enjoyed is just connecting more with students through social media. We've had more comments, we're doing more Instagram stories. And I think we're not getting like tons more more followers, but I feel like our students who followed us there already are paying a little more attention. So I hope that kind of sticks through the whole remote learning situation. What about you?
That's cool. I think I saw somewhere that you guys were doing like personal like videos, like short little videos about each librarian was picking a topic or something.
Yeah, we tried doing that. I think we have to try again. We had some technological difficulties with Instagram Live. But yeah, the director of New York City did a baking video. I did a podcast video. Mm-hmm. Someone was going to do one on gardening. I wanted to do another one with the whipped coffee.
Oh yeah.
And show everybody how to do that. But like I said, we have a meeting this week. Maybe I think we're going to try it again and see if we can make it work.
Right. Oh, that's fun. I like that personal touch. I think it's fun for the students to see the librarians humanized, you know?
Yeah. And I think we're going to start using Instagram stories, the way that a lot of other people are using it, with the templates that you can make, mm-hmm. like this or that, or fill in like what's your favorite this, what's your favorite that, and then copy and paste it and other people can use it. I'm using it personally for like the 30-day music challenge. So I think we're going to do one and use the Instagram stories for more engagement that way, and then try to promote chat through Instagram stories. And we have all these fun ideas that are just kind of an entertaining thing to do outside of instruction. It's instruction in a way, I guess, right? It's instruction outreach through social media.
Absolutely. I think it's getting students engaged, one, in who you are as people. And I think it's also getting them engaged in learning new things that they thoroughly learn. So yeah, I mean, it goes back to the lifelong learning thing. So I think it all works for sure.
Right.
So my learning this week is not educational. It's not library related. I have been participating in some, I've been keeping up on Twitter with my Twitter is basically all library land. So like, I've been like reading a lot on Twitter, and I've been, I did read through some of those digital posters through ACRLDLS this week, but like, I didn't learn anything. But so my learning thing this week is non-library related. I learned how to make a new soup.
Oh my gosh.
So last Sunday, we didn't celebrate Easter with our entire family, but I did cook a ham. And I'm always mad at myself because I never get through the whole ham. So I finally found a new way to use the leftovers for something different. So I did a ham and potato soup.
Ooh.
No, it came out really good. It took me a 30-minute soup. It was super quick. So that was fun. So I learned something new that, I think it's a recipe I'll remember. And then something that was super challenging and super nerdy is I learned how to sew a bunny nose. I didn't think it would be that challenging. So I've been crocheting this bunny for my daughter. And the last thing I had to do was sew on the nose. And it was so challenging, to keep it straight. And I think aren't super geeky, but I watched tutorials and looked at pictures of how to do it. And it took me 10 tries. I finally did it, and it's not perfect, but it definitely looks homespun, but it's done. So
our knitting listeners will know what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. So if you're knitters or sewers, or I don't know, it was super challenging to me. I think it's something so simple, but I did actually go and look up the best way to do it. So
because you're creating this whole little physical being from scratch, but the hard part is the nose. It seems so counterintuitive.
So frustrating. Maybe next week I'll have something more scholarly. We'll see.
Right. And I'm still expecting a guitar video. So let's go.
the second verse of the song. So we're getting there. We're getting there.
Okay, good.
Yeah. All right. So that wraps up another episode. And here's where you can find us. You can find the podcast at librarian_guide. You can find Jessica at librarygeek611. And you can find me, Amanda, at historybuff820. Our email is info@teachingpodcast@gmail.com. Be sure to rate and subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen. We love to hear from you in the reviews as well.
So look out for episode 16, our last one on the framework.
Yes. And starting tomorrow, after this episode gets released, we will be sending out a series of tweets where we are hoping you will participate and we can kind of comment on some of your thoughts on the framework.